Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Welcome, everyone, to a very special session in the series of Sfarim Bashana. We are here tonight, and the special treat and opportunity is to hear my father, Shlita, who will be talking about three luminaries of the 20th century. We're getting a little bit out of order because there couldn't be anybody better to do this than my father, and I'll tell you why. He's going to be speaking about Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Aaron Cutler, and Rav Yosef Soloveitchik. My father has the distinction, he won't tell you this, but he has the distinction of being one of the few writers who has actually written tributes to these individuals. And the reason that he's one of the few is because these individuals within the Orthodox world don't really come from the same world, believe it or not. It's maybe an unfortunate reality that within the Orthodox world there are different camps. As of late, in the last 20 or 30 years, the camps didn't overlap. And my father is one of the few people who was viewed as qualified by everyone to write tributes to Rav Yosef Bo Soloveitchik after his passing, and about other Gedolim as well. And I will tell you that one of the first articles of writing that I ever read that my father wrote was an article that appeared in Tradition magazine in the 1960s. I was a young teenager flipping through the pages of Tradition and found an article that my father wrote defending the integrity of the leaders of the Orthodox world, the Gedolim, the giants of the Orthodox world, against an absolutely offensive assault by someone who ought to have known better. And I remember at the time being very proud of the fact that my father was somebody who stood up to make that statement. So he's obviously very qualified to talk about these three luminaries who had a tremendous impact that still resonates to this very day and beyond on the Torah world. And so without any more delay, I'll give you my father, Rabbi Emanuel Feldman.
Good evening. Happy to be here, and happy to have you all be here with us together. My assignment tonight is a very difficult one. It's a difficult one because I'm going to be talking about three great luminaries in Gedolim and Poskim of the 20th century, each of whom is entitled to an entire year's course. And I'm supposed to be doing three of them in one evening and to be finished, well, within 45 minutes or so. So it's a tough job. Also, I'm going to be talking about three men who are probably more responsible for the resurrection of Orthodox Judaism in the 20th century than anyone else, and about three men about whom most Jews never heard. You know, you talk to most Jews, and who are the most famous Jews of the 20th century? They'll say Albert Einstein, Hank Greenberg, Detroit Tigers, just want you to know. Okay. In music, it'd be Leonard Bernstein. In literature, it would be Saul Bellow, won the Nobel Prize. I'll go through the whole list of Nobel winners. There's so many in there. But nobody has heard, or very few Jews have heard, of Moshe Feinstein, of Rav Aharon Cutler, or maybe a few more have heard of Rav Yosheber or Joseph B. Soloveitchik. So my purpose tonight is to familiarize you with those three names, so that in the future when you hear those names, you'll know, have some idea of who they were and the kind of contribution they made to Jewish life. Among learned Jews, among halachic Jews, among, you know, Orthodox Jews who study Torah, these are household names. as I say, completely unknown to most other Jews. And when the history of the remarkable resurrection of Orthodox Judaism in the 20th century is written, when that history is written, it is these three men, plus a few others like them for whom we don't have time to deal with, but there are other equally great Russia yeshiva of the 20th century who are really responsible for the resurrection of Orthodoxy. You know, other groups of Jewish life were busy in the 20th century building magnificent synagogues, and while all this was going on, Orthodox Jews, with the guidance of such people as we're going to talk about tonight, insisted on Torah learning and halacha practice as a guide. And they slowly, quietly founded schools, day schools, all over the country. And yeshivas all over the country. And set very, very high standards. And these are larger-than-life people, and I think that they saved Judaism from extinction in the 20th century. Now, how does one become a great posek, a decisor of Jewish law, as these people were? How does one become a gadol, a great scholar and great rabbinic leader, as these three were? I mean, no one gives out certificates that you're a great scholar. No one gives out a diploma after a certain amount of years of study that you are entitled to call yourself a gadol, a great Jew. There are no elections. There's no white smoke going up the chimney. Besides, these are the greatest Jews of the 20th century. What is required, number one, is an encyclopedic knowledge of all of Judaism. That trips off the tongue very easily. An encyclopedic knowledge of the entire Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud, of the commentators on the Talmud, of the Torah, Nevi'im and Ksuvim, of the Tanakh, that preceded the Talmud, the Mishnah, of course, the commentaries following the Talmud, the responsa literature following that, going through several centuries, up to and including the 20th century. An encyclopedic, literal encyclopedic knowledge of all of that in one head. That's what's required. And My father, Zichron Livracha, who was a Rav in Baltimore, used to compare the level of learning in American yeshivos to the level of learning in European yeshivos. It's interesting that these three men that we're talking about tonight were all trained in Europe. Then they came to live in the United States. He says the level of learning is best described by the one sentence he used to tell me. In European yeshivos, to know the Talmud by heart is the first step in becoming a scholar. Step number one, know the Talmud by heart, and then we'll sit down and talk. And that's why, you know, my dad, for example, could cite any place, any line in the Talmud, page, verse, how many lines from the Bar Ilan remembers this when he was a little boy. He used to play games with us. And how many words from the margin the word appears. That's how they knew the Talmud. The way you know, let's say, Shema Yisrael, right? Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. That's the encyclopedic knowledge, like that, of all of Jewish literature. Classical, halachic Jewish literature. In addition to that, to become a decisor or a posek or a gadol, all the same, you need to have unimpeachable integrity. A key. Your character must be unimpeachable. And how do you become recognized? Again, there's no diplomas, there's no certificates, and no examinations. Through the approval and the acceptance of your peers. I mean, how does a great surgeon become known as a great surgeon, great brain surgeon? Because all the other brain surgeons recognize him as a top person. That's how a great rabbi becomes a great rabbi, because all the other great rabbis recognize him as the pinnacle of who they are. So we'll talk about Rav Moshe Feinstein first. We had a joke when we were being ordained and received our smicha in my day in the 50s, that on the back of the certificate that you got, the ordination of the rabbi, they were scribbled the phone number of Rav Moshe Feinstein. It was very true. I myself had to call him many times. You always had a problem, particularly young rabbis in the 50s, 60s, of you had the need to talk to someone more knowledgeable than you. And when, as I was in my 20s, everybody was more knowledgeable than I, it wasn't a problem. I had a tremendous advantage. Try to fix this microphone, but it's not going too well. I had a tremendous advantage in that my father was a very, very good scholar, and I was able to pick up the phone and talk to him. But I'll tell you one instance. There was one particular case that had to do with marriage and divorce, with illegitimate children. It was extremely complicated as far as Jewish law was concerned. I didn't want to touch it. I had just come here. I was about 26 years old, so I didn't want to touch it. I couldn't handle it. So I called up my father. My father heard me out, and I heard a deep sigh on the other end of the phone. And he said, "Oi," he says, "I can't handle this. I don't want to handle this. Call Rav Ruderman." Rav Ruderman was the head of the yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, happens to be Miriam Feldman's grandfather. Call Rav Ruderman, discuss it with him. All right, I hang up the phone, I dial Rav Ruderman. Fortunately, because of my father, I had immediate access to these people. I tell Rav Ruderman the story, a deep sigh. Oh, he says, "I can't handle it. I can't handle this." He says, "Besser ruf Rav Moshe. Better call Rav Moshe Feinstein." And that's what it is. I called Rav Moshe Feinstein, and he said he'd call me back in a half hour, and he did, and he gave me a way out of the problem. That was Rav Moshe. He was the pinnacle to whom everyone else turned. He was like the chief justice of the court. Everyone turned to him. He reluctantly undertook the task of responding to the shilas and the questions and the referrals that he received from all over the world in his humble office on the east side of New York. But he felt it was a duty, that he had to do it, that someone had to do it, and he had broad shoulders, and he did it. What he did was he took Jewish law, halacha, he took it out of the deep freeze, where it threatened to be stuck. And he made it a dynamic, living creature, Jewish law. His Igros Moshe, which is the name of his 7 or 8 volume set of shalos tshuvos, of responsive literature, of questions that were sent to him and answers that he gave, and plus the dozens of Talmudic commentaries that he had, are a major contribution to the revival of Jewish law and halacha in the 20th century. And he demonstrated that there isn't a shiloh, there isn't an issue that comes up in modern life that can't be covered and can't be addressed by Jewish law. I'll give you some examples in a moment. I mean, nothing was too complex. Nothing was too difficult. From moon travel to latest procedures in medical science, he knew the Talmud, he knew the sources, everything was at his fingertips, and he was able to apply the ancient principles to modern problems and to contemporary issues. For example, someone wrote him that in the early days of dialysis, that there was only a certain amount of dialysis equipment available in a certain hospital, and a number of people needed it. Who gets precedence? How do you judge who gets precedence? So he has a whole long, involved teshuva response about that based on ancient sources. I won't go into that, but the example of the type of things he's dealing with. Someone else wrote, there's someone in my community who's very, very sick. He's terminal. Everyone says he's terminal. The doctors say they can prolong his life, but to prolong his life means that he'll just prolong his suffering. Can we withhold medicine from him so that he'll die sooner than he normally would with the medicine? Because there's no hope of a cure. Question of organ transplants. Originally, when they first came out, everybody turns to Rav Moshe Feinstein. How do we handle the problem, the question of organ transplants? Question of halachic status of marriages that were performed not according to Jewish law. Wasn't it a Jewish couple that was just married not by a rabbi, but by a justice of the peace? Are they considered married? If they're considered married, then they get a divorce, they have to have a religious divorce as well. If they're not considered married, they don't need a religious divorce. What about their children? I'm going ahead of myself. Supposing they get a religious divorce, I'm supposing they get a civil divorce, and the woman remarries. Is the woman who remarries guilty of being a married woman who married someone else? In other words, is the second husband guilty of marrying a married woman because she never had a civil divorce or religious divorce? Or does she not need a religious divorce since she wasn't married halachically in the first place? So maybe she's free and clear. She never was married halachically, so she doesn't need a get. She doesn't need a divorce, so the second man who marries her is not in violation. And consequently, any future children are not illegitimate. Because if you marry a woman who is legally, halachically married, and doesn't have a divorce, a Jewish divorce, any future offspring are, according to halacha, illegitimate. With serious, serious consequences. That was one of the major issues that Rav Moshe used to deal with in his book, in his Igros Moshe. Extremely self-effacing man. I had the privilege of knowing him and dealing with him in person. He was self-effacing, but he was very much aware of who he was. And that's a trick. Lahavdil, similarly, Moshe Rabbeinu is said of him in the Torah that he was the most humble man who ever walked the face of the earth. Does that mean Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know who he was? Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know that he was the only one on Sinai to get the tablets? Didn't know that he took the Jews out of Egypt? Didn't know that he was leading them through the desert? Of course he did. But he was the most humble man on earth, because he knew that all of this was not because of him, but gifts that God had given him. In another way, Rav Moshe Feinstein was similar. He was totally self-effacing, and yet he knew that he had this responsibility to bring halacha up to modern times. The man had no ego. He once walked 20 blocks in New York snow to be present at the wedding of one of his students, because the student expected him and there couldn't be, and there was no vehicular traffic, so he walked the 20 blocks. And a personal story, my wife's cousin was once at a wedding. She was a married woman of about 40 to 45 years old. She was had recently been widowed. After the wedding, she was sitting in the lobby of the wedding hall waiting for a taxi to pick her up. And an elderly gentleman came down and sat down near her and said to her, "Are you alone?" And she said, "Yeah, I'm alone." And she was an elderly man. She told him that she's a widow and it's not easy. And he was very sympathetic with her. And he talked with her for about 20 minutes until two young yeshiva boys came by and said, "Ramesha, your car is here." It was Ramesha Feinstein spending a sympathetic time with a woman he had never met in his life. They tell a story that in his office in the east side of his yeshiva, a lady knocks at the door of his office, and he had a male secretary. Secretary comes and says, "May I help you?" And she said, "Yes, he wants to see the Rosh Yeshiva." And the secretary says, "He's very busy now. Can I help you?" She says, No, I have to see him. I want him to translate this letter. I get a letter from Russia every week, and I want to ask him to translate it." So the secretary was taken aback. He says, "Well, you can get anybody to translate." She says, "Yes, but he does this for me every week because I get a letter every week, and I always bring it in to him." That's what he did. He took care of this lady's problem for her. Now, where Rav Moshe was very calm and soft-spoken and quiet, Rav Aaron Cutler, who's the second man on our list tonight, was anything but soft-spoken. He was fire himself. He was like a burning flame, filled with enthusiasm and passion for Torah. The fact that everything in America was against what he stood for didn't matter to him. And although his knowledge of Talmud was equal to Rav Moshe Feinstein's, his forte was not Shalos HaTshuvos or responsa literature. His strength was the vision of what the future of American Torah life should be like. He was the visionary with eyes on the future. When he came to America after World War II, he met an Orthodox Jewry that was literally gasping for breath. I mean, it had abandoned all hope for the future. Orthodox Jews were convinced that there was no hope at all, that they were down for the count. Even in Orthodox circles, the idea of someone spending time studying Torah for Torah's sake was unheard of. Rav Aaron came in to the United States, didn't know the language, and he founded a new model yeshiva, which was emphasizing Torah study exclusively. It was an emergency situation, he felt, and he had to reinvent Torah study for American young people and for the American adult Jewish community. And he made yeshiva in America just like the yeshiva in Europe. And he deliberately did not found his yeshiva in New York City, as everybody else was doing. He moved out into a little town in New Jersey called Lakewood, which today is a bastion of Torah in the Western world, Lakewood. It's second only to Jerusalem in its piety, maybe even more pious than Jerusalem. He insisted on the highest levels of Jewish learning, and he began the first kollel. I think it was the first kollel in America was founded in Lakewood. And he certainly is the father of the kollel system throughout the United States. You have kollelim today in every city, every major city in the United States. Not only in Atlanta, you have Dallas, you have Los Angeles, you have Chicago, you have Cleveland, Detroit. There are kollelim everywhere. Miami. He was the father of all the kollelim. The idea that a young man, a married man, instead of going out into the field or whatever he wanted to do, would spend X number of years after he was married and after he was ordained, continuing the intensive study of Torah. Only for Torah's sake and for teaching others and spreading Torah to the communities in which they resided. He had an overpowering love for all of his students, and he was totally dedicated to the primacy of Torah study above all else. And when he died, there were 300,000 people at his funeral. Same is true of Moshe Feinstein. 300,000 people at each of their funerals. So much had they affected different lives in the United States. I was present at part of the funeral of Rav Moshe. He's buried in Jerusalem on Purim. And I remember you couldn't park anywhere nearby. I had to take a taxi home. And the taxi driver, who was not at all religious, said to me, "Who was the funeral for?" I said, "It was for a great rabbi." He says, "I'll never have a funeral like that." He was so sad and admiring. He couldn't believe that so many hundreds of thousands of people would turn out for one individual like Rav Moshe. So that's of Aaron. Rav Aaron Kuppler brought fire down from heaven and planted it in the Torah world of the United States. There was nothing casual about his approach. It was all passion and excitement and enthusiasm. The third person we're going to deal with, I'm going through very quickly, is Rav Yoshe Ber. Those who knew him used to call him, his Talmidim, his students called him Rav Yoshe Ber. The other students would call him J.B., Joseph B. Soloveitchik, behind his back. It was different from the other two. Although all three of them, Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Aaron Kuppler and Rav Joseph B. Soloveitchik, were on wonderful terms with one another and respected one another. There was no rivalry among them. He used his role of Soloveitchik as a vehicle for uplifting orthodoxy, not from the scholarly standpoint, but from the intellectual standpoint. Let me tell you what it was like in the 50s. None of you remembers the 50s because you weren't born yet. Right? Right. Okay. In Atlanta in the 50s, you had to be out of your mind to be an Orthodox rabbi or to have an Orthodox synagogue. Thank God I was out of my mind. But everybody else thought I was out of my mind too. All the power in the community and all the money in the community and all the influence in the community was in non-Orthodox hands. Orthodoxy was the poor child, the poor little brother. There were depressing times. There was no hope for the future of an Orthodox synagogue in Atlanta, and that was true all over the United States, the exception perhaps of the big cities of New York or Boston or Baltimore, but all over the United States in the smaller cities, it was hopeless. I used to travel once or twice a year to New York to the conventions of rabbis just to hear Rav Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik give his annual shiurim. Because those shiurim, those lectures, lifted me up. raised my spirits, gave me courage to continue the fight that we had here in town. And I was not the only one. There were dozens and dozens like us whose spirits were lifted just by listening to him and by being inspired by the way, the clarity with which he addressed the issues facing modern American Jewish life. He really kept at bay single-handedly the inroads of the conservative movement. The conservative movement in the 50s threatened to take over all of Jewish life. They were powerful and they were attractive because they weren't that orthodox and they weren't that reformed. They were attractive. And he was the only one who pointed a finger at us and kept us within the fold. I remember coming back always uplifted by him. He showed us the intellectual rigor of halacha, the profound worldview that's found in the minutiae of halachic living. He demonstrated the universality of Torah, and he kept us young, modern, orthodox rabbis from abandoning the ship. He was a very strange person. I'll tell you why. He was, I don't mean strange in the negative sense, but unusual, unique. He was a traditional Rosh Hashiva, encyclopedic knowledge of everything. The grandson of the great Rav Chaim Brisker, who changed the course of Talmudic study several generations ago. The name Soloveitchik is like Einstein in the world of Talmud. He was a true genius in every sense of the word. He was a traditional Rosh Hashiva with a doctorate in philosophy from the University of Berlin. He was a Talmudic genius who was familiar with the philosophy of people like Heidegger and Kierkegaard. He was a maverick. Though fully observant and extremely religious, and some of his former disciples tell me that when they stood next to him at Shmona Esrei, just a weekday mincha, they felt like it was Yom Kippur, the way he davened. It was not just mumbling words. He was speaking to God. That was Rav Yosher Baer in his religious garb. And yet, he didn't always toe the party line. He didn't wear the Hamburg. He didn't wear the long black kapota. He wore a plain hat, plain suit. He dealt with modern themes like alienation and loneliness and defeat and retreat and pain and suffering. And he used to always say it is only the saving quality of Torah study which makes it possible for a lonely man to reach out confidently to lonely God. I remember vividly like today how he said he made a line that stuck with me forever. He said, God is the most lonely creature in the world. There's no one like him. He has no one to talk to except the people of Israel. Hashem Echad, God is one. God is lonely. Man is lonely. So the lonely man and woman reach up to the lonely God. That was the meaning, said of Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. His lectures were very personal. He didn't mind stopping and asking a question of someone in his audience to make by name, because he knew everybody. And we would dread. He would say, Feldman, what do we think of such and such? Or we had to be alert listening to him. He once confided to his audience of thousands that after his wife's death, and he was very, very close with her, after she died, he said, I thought I would go mad. And were it not for my immersion in Torah study and in halacha, I would have gone mad. He had the whole audience weeping. He legitimized orthodoxy in America. He was a great speaker, one of the great orators of the 20th century in any language, in any field. A spellbinding speaker. I remember as a student in Baltimore, I'm a senior student, I was about 23, 24. I remember cutting classes one afternoon to go to hear him speak. That was the, you know, the worst thing you could do in those days. I mean, you know, you cut classes to go to hear a speaker, you know, you're not supposed to do that. A terrible crime, you know. I went to hear him speak. I remember he spoke, he started at 2 and he ended at 5. 3 hours. And I was standing on my feet the whole time. And it seemed like 3 minutes. He was that type of a speaker. His use of language was not just language. It was a powerful instrument, language was, in his mouth. Both in Yiddish, he spoke a Yiddish, the kind of Yiddish you never heard. Magnificent Yiddish. His English, adopted language, magnificent. And I'll tell you a story about Yosher Bear. A story that typifies him and also typifies the Gedolim that we speak about tonight. He used to teach at Yeshiva University. He taught Talmud. It was then Yeshiva College. He taught the senior class in Talmud. He was a very rigorous teacher. A very tough teacher. He demanded certain standards. He expected those standards to be kept. People had to be prepared with the Talmud page before they walked into his class. They had to know it well, because he wasn't just teaching Talmud, he was going into the depths of it. And one time, he was immersed with his class in trying to reconcile a page of Gemara with something that the Rambam, the Maimonides, was saying, which seemed to contradict something that Nachmanides was saying, and it had to do with all kinds of the Rishonim, the early decisors of Jewish law, extremely complex matter. And he was trying to reconcile all of this before his students. There was a give and take. One student raised his hand and tried to rebut Rav Soloveitchik's thesis. And Rav Soloveitchik was always willing to listen to rebuttal. But he said, no, Greenberg. No, you're off base. It's not right. No, you're wrong, no. Okay? The bell rang. The class was over. Most of the young fellows left the classroom. One or two remained. And Rav Yosher Bear is sitting at his desk like this. Suddenly he springs up from his chair. He says, Greenberg, where's Greenberg? He said, Rebbe, he went to eat lunch. Find him. I'll find him myself. He ran out of the room. In the hall he's calling, Where's Greenberg? He runs down the steps across the street. The lunchroom's across the street. He bursts into the lunchroom. Where's Greenberg? Oh, he's sitting over there. He runs over to where Greenberg is sitting eating lunch and he says, Greenberg! You were right, and I'm wrong. That's the kind of intellectual honesty that Torah demands and that he really represented. So here we have these three individuals, and Rabbi Lerner, I'm calling you in a few minutes to fill in any gaps. There are many gaps. Moshe Feinstein is symbolic of compassion, besides the encyclopedic knowledge that he had, compassion, generosity, the courage to take on issues that others did not want to take on, his own piety, obviously his own faith. Aaron Cutler embodies fire, fire. I remember hearing a lecture from him they gave exclusively to American rabbis, in which he castigated us for not studying enough. Torah is the answer to everything. Fire, passion. Rav Yosher Ber, Joseph B. Soloveitchik, intellectual reverence, relevance, I'm sorry, of Torah and Halacha. Rav Aaron was fire, Rav Yosher Ber was cool, ice, rational. And for all of these three, for each of these three, the greatest contribution is that they develop disciples and students that today are leading communities around the world, in the United States, in Europe, and in Israel. As I mentioned earlier, all three of them trained in Europe and were products of European yeshivas. All three loved and respected one another. But they had different emphases. One is the practical application of halacha to daily life, that's Rav Moshe Feinstein. One was that Torah is not a casual thing, it's a fiery thing, that's Rav Aaron Cutler. And one was the intellectual person who created bridges between the world of Torah and the world of philosophy. Their books, this is a great book session, I haven't mentioned their books, but there's no point in mentioning their books unless you speak Hebrew and read Hebrew well, and Talmudic Hebrew. Rav Moshe Feinstein, Igros Moshe, the Letters of Moshe, which are published in 8 volumes, containing his halakhic questions addressed to him and the answers he gave, which forms part and parcel of the corpus of halakhic literature, plus as many commentaries on the various books of the Talmud. Rav Aaron, his forte was not, as I say, Tshuvos and Shailos. He wrote a sefer called Mishnas Aharon, dealing with crucial halakhic matters. And Rav Yosher Ber Soloveitchik, while he has one book, Halakhic Man, it's in English, translated from the Hebrew, I don't suggest that you read it, because it might as well be Talmudic Hebrew. It's very, very difficult, very, very very, very Talmudically oriented. But those other books, they are definitely major contributions to the future of Jewish life. And as I'll end the way I began, and that is, without these three, plus there are others like them, there's Rav Ruderman, there's Rav Huttner, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, there's a whole list of greats like that, there would be no Jewish life in the United States today, with all the Einsteins, and with all the Saul Bellows, and with all the Nobel Prize winners, and with the Leonard Bernsteins. These were the people who kept us going. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.